Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.
This is Jason Little, the world's greatest cold fusion developer, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising podcast. Welcome to another episode of the Agile Uprising podcast. I am solo this time, your host, Chris Merman, and we have a special guest. You have seen, if you have a Twitter account, you have seen a tweet about this, I guarantee you, or Amazon has tried to automatically deliver this to your device. I don't know how he's getting Amazon to do this. A book just showed up on my door one day and I was happy to read it, but our buddy Ryan Ripley is here to talk about his book. Hey, Ryan.
Merman, how you doing? And by the way, congratulations on your recent nuptials. You are, it's awesome. Kristen and I are super happy for you and just wish the best for you and your lovely bride.
Well, thank you. It's one of those things where you just kind of wake up one day and realize, oh, I guess this has changed. And I guess life's different now. As you told me long ago, that when you do it right, it feels more natural. So I'm thankful to be part of it. So cool. Yeah, Ryan and his wife Kristen have been friends for a really long time, and she is encouraging just as much as Ryan has when I went through the dating world, and I'm now thankfully done with that part of my life, onto a new page. So the Ryan's book that I just mentioned, Fixing Your Scrum, Practical Solutions to Common Scrum Problems. So I talked with you, God, how long ago did you start writing this book, Ryan? Like a year and a half ago, a year, something like that?
2 years ago, I think.
Two years ago.
Yeah, sometime in late 2017 or mid 2017. It was actually, so this book started at a, there's a table at Agile 2017, like a table outside of the conference area. And I was talking to Jeff Langer. And if for those of you that don't know Jeff Langer, he starts talking about like, hey, you should write a book, just run. Because he will sell you on this. And then Jeff's a good friend, really, really awesome technical coach. And I was sitting with Jeff and he was asking me some Scrum questions. And I just went on a soapbox rant for a while. And he's like, wait a minute, I think you've got a book in you. And I'm like, that's awesome, but there's no way. And now you know, those of you that have been to the big Agile conference, you know, you end up in a bar at some point and we're still talking. And I was like, you know what, just set it up, you know, hook me up with the editors. And so Jeff made some connections back, you know, at the Agile conf, and I met some people and we got a deal signed pretty quick. And I was real excited about it and fired up. And then about four or five chapters in, I just flamed out. Like I really was in over my head. I was really struggling because at that point I was starting a new company and I had, I've been blessed with just a ton of training work. So as a professional Scrum trainer with scrum.org, you know, I stay pretty busy traveling the country, teaching, you know, public and private classes all over the country. And I just really was having trouble balancing family and this new booming business and this book. And I, you know, it almost died. And at one point I reached out to my very good friend, Todd Miller, who's another trainer who's, you know, passionate about the same kind of Scrum things that I am. And I said, hey, Todd, I really need some help. What if we paired up? What if we pair write this thing? Unfortunately, whenever I propose something to Todd, he's like, yeah, let's do it. He just jumps in. And so he's like, sure. And we got him signed onto the project. And then I got kind of re-energized and he brought a new energy and a different perspective. And over that next year and a half, like we really brought together, you know, we didn't just catalog anti-patterns. We actually brought forth, you know, what are the things we've seen? And then what are the things we've tried when we see these bad patterns? Like we're not trying to be super prescriptive, but what we're trying to do is say, when Todd and I step foot into a company and we see these anti-patterns. Here's all the things we've tried. Here's all the theory we've tried to teach. Here's all the stuff that we've done. And we've collected this into, you know, a 242-page book that hopefully people can flip to. You know, if you're having trouble with your daily scrum, flip to the daily scrum chapter, read about the theory, check out our stories, how, you know, and the book is just full of every way that Todd and I have failed at using scrum, which was kind of a weird moment. We had a crisis of conscience there too. We're like, ooh, we're really showing how bad we are at this. But I think in the end, you know, 40 plus combined years of experience with different ideas to kind of diagnose and some antidotes to these patterns. And if that doesn't work, we provide a coach's corner section in each part of the book. That's just, hey, if these other things aren't great, try this next idea, you know, try this liberating structure, try this facilitation technique. And so it's an immensely practical book, right? That's kind of how it happened.
You know, that it's interesting, the tone which that you're bringing up, right? I am curious to hear like how you all chose the voice of the book. It, you know, if it was part of the editor's process or just, it's just the way that I, you know, what I know of you, this feels like just that I'm talking to you kind of a thing. So yeah. I don't know if it was kind of you and Todd just kind of naturally being yourself, but traditionally, you know, when we think of like the Scrum Bible, you know, we think of the Mike Cohn book that all of us read when we were first getting started. It was how I was first introduced to the framework. Someone just handed me it and said, read this, kind of a thing. So yours is a vastly different tone. It's more of a, you know, just kind of a, like you said, like we're sitting around the table at a conference having a conversation about it. Was that intentional by you all? And how'd you pick that?
Yeah, so we took a look at the market, like PragProg, you know, the Pragmatic Bookshelf, you know, Andy Hunt and Dave Thomas's publishing group, they were very clear that this needed to be a practical, pragmatic book. It can't just be theory. And you're right. So Mike Cohn has some great books out there on Scrum. I think Ken Rubin's Essential Scrum is part of Mike's series. So that's been done. And that's been done to death. Like there's 20 books out there on the market that will teach you the basics of Scrum. And so Todd and I, we decided we're not going to do that. We don't want to, we were kind of riding in certain directions where we were, you know, falling back into that pattern. And we had an amazing editor. So Dawn Shannonfelt is just, I mean, she's awesome. Like she made Todd and I sound far more intelligent than what we deserved and kept it conversational. You know, she was like, guys, you're getting heavy in theory, low on practice, or this. I mean, there were a few chapters where we were super proud. And then she reads it. She's like, this is boring. And I edited about a quarter of the way through and I stopped because I was falling asleep. So fix this, you know, put a story in here, make it, you know, act like we're just talking to each other. Like we really wanted a conversational, friendly tone, but we also wanted people to read it and actually go do something, not just highlight a few passages, you know, write a blog post about some theory and move on. It was, you know, they're going to read a chapter and the next chance they get to work with their team, they're going to try something. And that's what we wanted. We wanted to be different in that because the world does not need another intro to Scrum book, but
no.
we're hoping that this pragmatic approach, you know, if you read this book and you go work with your teams and, you know, one good idea leads to, you know, some great inspection and adaptation that, you know, clears an impediment or helps your team deliver, it's probably worth the cover price. And that's kind of the approach we took. But for the tone and all that, Dawn is 100% to thank for that. She took our stuff and crafted it into something far better than what Todd and I on our own could have been capable of doing.
Yeah. So for those that haven't gone through the writing process, it would be much simpler to just say, it's like Ryan : and then here's what Ryan says. And then Todd says, yeah. And it seems like you're reading a script, and it'd be really easy to do that. And he would seem conversational, but reading a conversation is much more boring, is more boring than you would think. And it's so hard to have a single voice with two different people. I identified completely with what I got brought in halfway through the book on mobile development that years ago, that's way, 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 way out of date and is not even relevant anymore. But when I came in the writing process, it was halfway through, like Todd did. It's so hard to write it in a voice that makes it seem like you both are participating. And as we know from pairing, that's when really the best work happens. You have multiple ideas, multiple perspectives, but that's really hard to make come across. So I can I can appreciate that you all did that. So,
and now, Chris, real quick, yeah, I mean, the way that we manage that is interesting. We had a Trello board and we had, you know, cards for each chapter. So if I wrote the first draft of a chapter, Todd was responsible for all the edits and cleanup and polish for that chapter, and vice versa. So we actually made sure that we were, you know, there's some like co-authors who are like, all right, I'll write the first half of the book and you write the second half of the book. And, but we made sure that we had our tone. Each of us had an opportunity to craft and mold each chapter as we went. And then Dawn would come in and just do her amazing editing work. And I think that really helped, like having that, you know, surprisingly two Scrum trainers kind of use Scrum to deliver a book, you know, and we were working in week long sprints. We would try to release, and all of that, but just having that visualization of the work and making sure that whatever Todd was working on initially, I would clean up after. Whatever I worked on initially, Todd would clean up. And we just found this rhythm and flow that worked. And I think the other nice part is we're both pretty much aligned on our beliefs on Scrum. And so, yes, there were some debates. Yes, there was a few disagreements, but for the most part, we are in alignment on core principles, and we just bring different stories and perspectives to play.
So let's get into that piece. I like that, you know, it is really hard, especially when it comes to a framework, and we can talk about frameworks big picture in a second, but it is hard to say we see the framework or we see certain aspects of the framework the same. That's really, really difficult. What do you think about Scrum now? Because I mean, when you think about, when most people say, well, we're doing Agile, what they're really saying is we're doing Scrum. Scrum has become, in a way, and I don't know if this is a good or bad thing, but it's become synonymous with Agile in today's community, especially at the clients that I spend my time with. Where does Scrum stand right now? I mean, are you happy with the direction it's going? Is it one of those classic cars that needs some polishing? Is it just in need of an overhaul? Like, where do you, you know, I know where you're probably going to go because you're a trainer, but I mean, what do you, like, be honest now, like what do you think about the state of Scrum?
Oh, I think we're just getting started. And I know that might be a surprising answer to some people, but you know, Scrum's 20 years old and we're just now getting to where companies are successfully using it. And yes, there were successes in the past, but we're really seeing some, this is now it's like a 20 year journey to being an overnight success. You know, 90% of all teams who claim to be doing Agile are using Scrum. And that's phenomenal. And what's interesting is like Ken and Jeff, they haven't just sat around and just, you know, waited and let the world go by. They've updated the Scrum guide multiple times. You know, in 2017, they made some significant updates. I know that the user voice that's attached to the Scrum guide has been closed off for a little bit. That typically means there's some consideration going on for some updates. We'll see what that leads to. So they didn't just let it ossify, right? It's not just stagnant, right? So they've made updates along the way. They've adapted. But what I like about Scrum and why I think Scrum has stayed relevant and why I think Ken and Jeff literally changed the world, right? With Scrum being synonymous with Agile, for better or for worse, they changed the way we create products and software. And they will go down in history as two people who radically changed the way we work. They kept it relevant by staying at its core, which is empiricism. Right. So I actually am not that concerned about Scrum. And that surprises people when I say that. I believe in empiricism when it comes to product development in a complex domain. So if more is unknown than known about our work, and if we have to do experiments to learn what our customers need, and if we have to work to stay aligned with, you know, stakeholders and customers and management and leadership, and we have these different levels of alignment, and we're not sure which way to go because there's many good answers, that means experimentation is at the forefront, which means we learn through observation and through doing. And that means empiricism is essential, right? So work is transparent. We do quality inspections of that work, you know, by qualified people. And based on that transparent work and the result of the inspection, we make adaptations going forward, right? That's what I care about. And so far, Scrum is the best framework that I have come across, that I think the Agile world has come across, that brings empiricism to the forefront, that lets companies use empiricism as a competitive advantage, that allows us to leverage Scrum as a means to be opportunistic in the marketplace. Like, that's the stuff we're after. Like, I don't care if your daily Scrum you know, if a product owner is listening in the background, or I don't care if you want to use story points or t-shirt sizes, like all these basic arguments and conversations that come up. Yeah, it's interesting. But once you get past that, you realize we're here to learn. We're here to experiment. We're here to deliver. And I think we're just starting to have those conversations. We've gotten past the basics. And now we're kind of getting into this really fun age of product management. You know, Dave West, the CEO of Scrum.org, he's constantly saying, he's telling us constantly, it's like training community, this is the age of the product owner, right? We will either, you know, serve product owners well and provide them the tools and the frameworks and the means to get great products into the world that people want, or else we will fail. Like he's really like, and I agree. And so, Chris, we're getting started, man. We're finally through the initial stumbling blocks. We're no longer arguing about whether or not Scrum is good or bad. Like that's been a big shift in classes, right? You know, it used to be, you hear trainers, you know, back in my day, we had to spend half a day convincing people that Agile was good. And it's like, all right, go back to the mines. And it's like they're old gold miners or something. I don't know why I went there, but it's like now it's people are walking in going, we know we have to do this. You know, we watched the taxi industry get totally disrupted by Uber and Lyft. You know, we've watched, you know, Chris, I mean, we're kids of the 90s and late 80s. Yeah. Where's Blockbuster Video? Where'd it go? It died because they had a chance to buy Netflix and decided, nah, no one will ever want to stream programs, right? They were crazy. Like, so that inability to transparently look at your own work in the market, that inability to inspect what's actually happening in technology, and the refusal to adapt wrecked those companies. Whether it's the taxi industry, whether it's the hotel industry with Airbnb, whether it's Blockbuster or Kodak, they all refuse to really look at what's happening, learn from actually doing work, and adapt as needed. And today, go ahead.
You and I are the age. I think, you know, we're in our, you know, early 40s, something like this. If you're in your late 30s, early 40s, there is a good chance you've got more. We're the first generation that has less waterfall and less traditional software development history and more agile people. I don't get to be one of those people. I will never stand up and say, man, when we delivered software, I had like maybe 3 years of waterfall before someone showed me Scrum. And I don't really even remember those days anyways. It seemed weird then, it seemed weird now. Like we are a generation that's, we don't know another way to think. We are children of Agile, for lack of a better way to put it.
Yeah, and so for me, I entered the workforce in 2001. I worked primarily in Fortune 500 companies for most of my career. So I spent the first 12 years of my career in a waterfall environment. And so I can't wish for anything different, else I wouldn't be here talking to you today. But I mean, my background was more waterfall. It was 2013 when I went and took a class from Ken. And so what I remember is I loved project management. You know, I started as a developer. I shifted into project management. I loved the idea of, through sheer force of will, I will make this project happen because my Gantt charts are supreme. You know, all of this nonsensical thinking that you can just force things to happen. And Ken's class was an eye opener. It was an idea that you could work a little differently. And I brought these ideas back into the company I was with. And suddenly projects got a little simpler. The stress was going down. We were actually delivering more frequently. And so I got promoted, you know, and it was just a weird kind of shift, because you're right. Whether you spent 1 year or 12 years working in waterfall, it never felt quite right. It didn't seem fair. I mean, it didn't seem, you know, yeah, we're going to push people and punish them for being late, and we're going to try to predict 18 months out in advance, even though I don't know what I'm even going to have for dinner tonight. And all these like weird things that we're trying to do in work that we know can't possibly happen. But man, we're going to, and quite honestly, Chris, most of the waterfall projects, we plan these 18 month things, and we report back, it's green, it's green, it's green, it's green. It's like 50 shades of green until the very last status, and then it's red. And so when it goes red, we cut the remaining scope, still hit the date, and then still throw the party, even though we might have flushed a ton of value down the toilet. And that never felt right either. And so, I don't reminisce about the good old days, because those are in the past, and they weren't really that good. But today I like the idea that we always know where we're at. And I think just even working more transparently in Waterfall would make Waterfall better. But then adding on this framework and the inspection and the adaptations that it's okay to change direction, I think that made everyone's lives so much better.
I think 50 Shades of Green is a, so for any of you all out there, that's a great conference submission headline. Like, seriously, steal that and say, attribution Ryan Ripley, because that's gold right there. He has many other titles that piss off conference attendees, so you can have that one.
Well, I mean, the whole idea of red, amber, green, or red, yellow, green for status reporting has always blown my mind too. Like, when I work with companies that are like in their initial transition to agility, or they're just trying to just adopt some change, I'm like, you know what, just do this for a month. Go to your PMO and say, look, every project that we start starts red, not green.
Yeah.
We haven't delivered anything. We don't know anything. And as soon as we get to something deliverable that has customer feedback on it, now we can evaluate, are we yellow or green?
And we had a podcast on that very, very topic, and that's it. Andy Clef said that just like that. You need to prove to me you're worthy of being green, not the other way around.
I've been working that way for the past 20 years, and it disrupts PMOs. But you know what? It teaches the scrum teams or the dev teams or whatever kind of framework or process you're using. It teaches everybody we value delivery and we value feedback above all else. The planning is important, but the plan is secondary to actual feedback from a delivered product.
Yeah. Well, PMO deserves it if you mess with them. So you mentioned Dave's idea that, you know, we are in the age of the product owner serving the product owner, right? Yep. And yet you made a mention that your book is kind of written from a scrum master's perspective. And I kind of have some of my, you know, you go into it a little bit in the book, but I'm kind of curious. So in the age of product ownership, right, why did you all choose the scrum master viewpoint of the book?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the book is certainly a love letter to scrum masters, but it starts as a 2x4 and then it gets more kind. When we decided on the focus and the scope of the book, we decided we're going to write this, you know, with a scrum master in mind. Now, we do have plenty of things in there that product owners and managers and dev team members would benefit from. And so we hope all levels of the company are reading this book, trying to figure out how we can all collaborate and work better together. But something that Todd and I noticed, and we co-teach the advanced scrum master class quite a bit. And what we've noticed in that class is that product owners or scrum masters who come to that class don't know how to serve a product owner. They don't understand their role when it comes to working with a product owner. And what we're finding is when a scrum master abandons that product owner and only works with a dev team or only works outside in the organization, that product owner suffers, that bad alignment things happen, that agile product management is not well understood. And so we really are trying to help the product owners out there by helping scrum masters advance their game, level themselves up, so that they can show up and work with that product owner in a meaningful way to get, you know, really good product backlogs in place, to get, you know, quality refinement sessions happening, to get value well understood by the entire team, to bring the product vision forward. You know, and a product owner needs that scrum master. Todd and I call it, like, the relationship there is like the ride or die kind of relationship. Like, the scrum master and the product owner, they've got to feel that way about one another. Like, I'm not going into this product battle without you. And we got to find ways to get these scrum masters to actually really serve that product owner in a meaningful way. And so, yeah, we are unapologetically slanted and biased towards the scrum master, because we have found, whether it's a product owner anti-pattern or a dev team anti-pattern or a framework anti-pattern, the majority of these patterns, and I would dare say all of these patterns, can get tied back to a scrum master not correctly fulfilling their job or doing their role. And so we felt this first book, it has to have that scrum master bent, especially because halfway throughout writing it together, we both sat down and said, holy cow, we can tie all of these back to a scrum master who's apathetic, or a scrum master who's given up, or a scrum master who is tolerating organizational impediments that are preventing teams from delivering. And so we're trying to solve that problem first.
Well, and to be honest, that's, I think that the lack of connection between, if the Scrum Master doesn't take an idea of serving not just the team, but also serving the business needs, right? I mean, that's really at the heart of this, what I sometimes think is the biggest criticism. And I'm curious of what's the biggest criticism that you think is apt for Scrum? But a lot of what I feel is like, well, Scrum has sometimes it just takes waterfall and it makes it 2 weeks long as opposed to 18 months long, kind of a thing.
Right.
If it's not done right, you know what I mean? Like if you don't remove those invisible silos from your org, yeah, you may be talking every day with the business, but are you all sitting together? Does the business sit with the team? Does the Scrum Master see themselves as serving the team only, or do they see the product owner as part of the team? All of those little minutiae and those little slight tweaks and how sometimes the framework is sometimes misused is really where Scrum or Fall or whatever pick your favorite Scrum and Waterfall, hybrid word, right? That's where those come from is you've tried to take new activities, but with an old mindset, the whole dark Scrum post that we all know and love, yep. Right? That's where that comes from.
So Todd and I had a really interesting conversation about this just a couple of weeks ago, and he made a really good point. So Todd Miller is the genius behind this one. I think this is genius, where he said, look, most companies, they point at transparency as being the biggest problem. And he's like, you know what, dude, I don't think it's transparency. I don't even think it's inspection. We know what's wrong. We know what's there. We know what we need to change, but it's that adaptation that everyone skips. And so while you'll see a lot of trainers and consultants and transformation experts focus on that transparency and inspection part of the practice, it's actually that unwillingness to adapt that is actually the biggest criticism I would give to teams that are trying to adopt Scrum. And think about all the things you listed, Chris. You know, all those things that you listed off as some of the problems, it's an inability or unwillingness to change, right? The adaptation, like they know what they need to change. They know the silos need to come down. They know a truly cross-functional team has business and IT and data science and all these that's cross-functional, but they won't do it because of the reporting structures or the HR issues that come with it. Like whatever the things that you've rattled off there, they all come back to an unwillingness, inability, or a lack of desire to do the work that it takes to adapt.
Yeah.
I think that's the next phase here. Like, I think we've figured out like transparency for the most part's there. Like people are getting pretty good at expressing value on a product backlog and they're starting to use sprint goals. For God's sake, please use sprint goals. They're not optional. Sprint goals are not optional. Those tie back to product visions. And I think product owners are finally starting to set compelling, meaningful visions that inspire people and show us what we're after. But it's that adaptation. It's that removal of the impediment. It's that helping the organizational shift in a way that's beneficial to delivery. I think that's where the new game's going to be played. And I think that's, there's a big criticism of Scrum where, well, Scrum failed. Like that's the biggest criticism you could give it, right? Scrum is a failure. And I adamantly disagree. I think that's a completely incorrect statement. Scrum will do one of two things perfectly, each and every sprint. It will either empower a team to deliver a product that meets needs and that is somehow tied to value and that does some good in the world. It'll let you do that. Or it will show you every reason why you can't do that today. And it will do one of those two things perfectly every time. And if you find out that if Scrum is showing you that you can't actually get a piece of product or software out the door that's meaningful, that's impactful, that people want, well, then you have a choice. It's a decision tree, right? It's a decision to solve the impediments that you've discovered along the way, or it's a decision to rebrand and relabel all of your old practices and to revert back to those with the new Scrum terminology, but not change a thing. I think too many people are taking that easy road. And so what we've tried to do with this book, like Fixing Your Scrum, part of it is let's make adaptations easier and let's show the need to actually change and let's show the need to break down the silos and to change these patterns into better practices so that you can actually have a shot at creating high-performing teams that are capable of delivering increments of product each and every sprint.
Well, and to your point, I think that the leaders that I speak with, when they're okay with you sharing feedback, right? These are what teams are telling us. These are what programs are telling us. These are what whatever we're going through. They are now accustomed to receiving feedback in a better way. Now, to the point about data, I think that sometimes the reticence to change shows up in a variety of ways. My favorite is whenever you bring them stories. Hey, these are what teams are telling us. This is what we're hearing in retros. This is what, you know, workshops are coming out. We're constantly bubbling up this, and I'll hear, I don't want to hear stories. I don't want to hear anecdotes. I want data. And even when you show them the data, they go, that's not the data I want. And that's, again, that's that reticence to say, look, I'm okay with you sharing everything, but we're going to keep going. We're going to keep doing what we're doing, and we're going to respond in a slower fashion, because we don't really know how to respond we don't really know what to say when you say, well, okay, but when are you going to actually do some of these things?
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. That's why there's a chapter in the book that really shouldn't be there. We wrote a management chapter. My background is leadership. Like I took a different path than Todd. So Todd went developer, scrum master, and then heavy product ownership, and then some executive stuff that he's doing now. I went developer, project manager, scrum master, and then I went kind of the executive route as well. And so we both have a deep respect for management and leadership. And we see too many times where a scrum master will have conversations like, you know, the ones that you've mapped out, and then walk away going, management just doesn't get it, or management isn't needed in scrum, or management is awful. And they do these horrible statements that we do not believe at all.
Right.
And we want to help scrum masters get through that, because it is frustrating dealing with an executive who you disagree with. And so we put this chapter in to first and foremost say, look, these managers, these leaders, these executives, they're smart people. They know the company very well. They've played the game correctly for years. They've gotten promoted. We need to respect their needs as well. And it's going to take multiple conversations to actually learn about what they need and what they're after. And if they say, like, for instance, Chris, your example, well, those aren't the right metrics, then sit down with them and say, which metrics are correct and what new decisions would you make based on these metrics, and really get down to where their needs at, right? Yep. I think that's so important, to be a partner to the organization, a partner to these leaders and executives, and really showing that, you know, when they ask us a question that we may not agree with as Agilists, right? When leadership and management show up and say, what's this going to cost and how long will this take? As two examples of questions that make a lot of scrum masters cringe, we need to lean into those questions and say, those are perfectly reasonable questions. Here's our current forecast. Here's what we're projecting. Here's what we're thinking with the data we have. What new decisions does this information make available to you? And really lean into that relationship and make sure we're meeting their needs as well, because I just think that's been so overlooked and so mismanaged for so many years, that getting that right, just getting that relationship right, can make a scrum master's life better. It can help pave the way for your teams to do better. And it gets us out of these, you know, debates on data and metrics and OKRs and boulders and goals, and it gets us back to, look, we are here to deliver. That's it. Like, I'm not a squishy drum circle kind of agile coach, right? I am a scrum master who says, look, we're here to ship. And if we're not shipping, we're messing up. And what do we have to do to get something out the door? And it's probably my many years in the Fortune 500, where if you were in the bottom 10% as a performer, you were cut. I mean, but for me, it's like shipping is first, and then we get to go figure out like some of the more fun stuff. And for better or for worse, it served me pretty well.
Well, you know, it's interesting, because I know you so well. I started laughing when you were like, I'm a let's ship it. We just need to ship some stuff kind of guy. It's interesting. You entered the Scrum trainer space, you know, a couple of years ago. And what I find curious is, the more you train people, the more you get, you become an ambassador for not just the framework, but also what the framework wants to say is the way to do work, right? When you become that ambassador, it kind of forces you out of some of those black and white spots that I'm pretty sure I've heard you make references and, sure, you know, when I first met you kind of a thing, I haven't known you for forever kind of a thing, but I've known you long enough to know that there's still some black and white in you. And yet there's so much nuance. I find that interesting, that if Ryan Ripley can see the nuance and the gray areas in a framework, so can you kind of a thing. Is that, yeah, do you see that in yourself and how your work's changed?
You know what? I'm getting older and the beard is getting some grays and some whites in it, you know, and you know, the black and white, the absolute truth kind of arguments are fun, but I'm getting older and I need some naps. And you know, I just, the arguments were great back then, but it's kind of like, you know, there's room for nuance. And I'm really, that's been a shift in the last 5 years, I think, for me. It's, there's a lot of wonderful things to discover within this framework. There's a lot of gray area. It's a framework, right? There's a lot of space in between the 17 pages of the Scrum Guide to do some really smart things or to do some really dumb things. And I really want to help teams and companies pick more smart and less dumb. And, you know, but everything's nuanced and context is king. And, you know, part of, like, I think maturing is realizing that context is everything. And that just because one idea worked at one place, it does not mean it will ever work again. And I think we're just getting older, Chris. And maybe like wine, we're getting a little better with age.
I've never felt more rickety and stodgy than in this moment. We are young and hip, Ryan. I don't know you listeners can see us, but we are young and hip. Ryan took a journey towards swoleness last year, and
working on it.
I'm just saying, don't if you see him in a dark alley, you want him on your side, not against you, is what I'm
Mean, we're so young and hip. It's almost 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Tuesday, and after this, I'm gonna go take a nap. So that's how young and hip I am.
Okay, so I was so busy on making fun of how old we were that I dropped my question. So, all right, big picture.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times when people think of, you know, transformation and changing their IT orgs and changing the way they deliver stuff, a lot of times what they choose, and I don't really care the framework because we're not here to make fun of any particular framework or not, but most people just say, and as a consultant, I get told, enter your framework, right? Like whatever it is, like my job as a coach is not, hey, we want to improve these metrics. We want to make these outcomes different. My job is whatever. Do you feel like we're kind of post debate on whether or not a framework's part of at least in the US maybe? Do you think we're kind of post whether or not we use a framework as part of our transformation, and now it's just a matter of which framework?
I think we're always going to use something, and whether it's homespun or whether it's one of the big scaling frameworks or whether it's Scrum or whether you're going to use Kanban, I'm not so bent up on that anymore. If I just want to use real data, I want to make decisions based off of observation. I want to take a moment to inspect and adapt what we're doing to see if there's ways to improve the ways we're working. I want to get rapid feedback from customers. You know, I'm after these behaviors. And I think if you follow the principles of the Manifesto of Agile Software Development, if you take the 4 values and 12 principles and apply them to the way you work and you try to continuously improve on that, I'm kind of biased, but I think you're going to land on Scrum anyways. But I think if you're working in a way that honors that manifesto, when you say the word agile, all I see are 4 values and 12 principles. If you're honoring the value, if you're following those values and you're honoring the principles, I think you're going to end up in a good space anyways. And it's going to look a lot like Scrum. It could look a lot like Kanban. It could look a lot like, I don't know, some other framework that's yet to be discovered. But I'm not so hooked up on that discussion anymore. Just, you know, rapid feedback, continuous improvement, alignment to customer, honoring business needs, serving one another. Like, let's get that stuff right. And then we could, you know, and then at night we'll hit a bar and go argue about the frameworks and have that battle again.
Yes, we are. Even in 2020, there is still room for, I would love to think that we still have room and grace as an industry, even though we are now, to quote Otter, we are in the midst of the agile industrial complex. There is still room for, let's just have a drink and, you know, let's share some debate. And at the end of the day, we'll still be friends. Okay. Last question. But, and then, you know, I'll get you out. Yeah.
Chris,
go ahead.
I think with that kind of stuff, I mean, I'll throw this out there. I think most of us are just busy. Like you're a super busy guy doing your awesome stuff with, I don't know if you're allowed to say the name where you work, but I mean, you're doing your awesome stuff. I mean, I'm swamped. I'm booked through half of this year working with companies who are trying to deliver products. Most of our friends are traveling the globe, just swamped with work. We're busy. I don't have time to debate. I mean, I just wish people would just go out and do great work, put good things into the world, kind of tone it down a bit on, well, safe is awful or flex is weird or all that stuff, that the noise. It's just like, just go do good work. Like, just go out and be an awesome example to others on what it means to be a servant leader. Go out and help companies deliver. And if you're using, you know, Scrum at Scale or Safe or Scrum or you know, DSDM, Kanban, Crystal, Waterfall, whatever it is, you're putting good into the world. And if it's joyful work and the companies are getting value, you're ahead of the game. And let's just honor and respect that and kind of knock off a lot of this noise.
Yep. Use Twitter to share your content and lift each other up, because we need a lot of that these days.
It's better than the dumpster fire that the framework battles have become. And so I just stay busy, keep the head down, and try to put good work into the world.
Okay, so last joke question, and then we'll get you out of here. So once upon a time, Twitter was filled with tweets of Scrum is stupid, or as you said earlier, Scrum has failed, kind of a thing. It seems as though Safe has taken the mantle away from Scrum as the framework that's everybody loves to make fun of. Like, what's that? Sure. What's that shift been like for you as the one that used to receive all of the crap, and now you just get to watch it get dumped on another framework?
It's fun watching someone else have a disaster, and it's not fun living through that disaster. I'm not in the camp where I don't bash on Safe. I actually think Dean Leffingwell, in a very brilliant manner, capitalized on a huge gap in the marketplace, and he's bringing the idea of agility to companies. Quite honestly, I go in and do a lot of training at companies that initially started with Safe, but then they want to learn about professional Scrum and see how to amplify that aspect of their program. So I have no problem with what they're doing. I personally don't teach it right now. I'm not sure if I ever will. There are great people in the professional Scrum community. Like Yuval Yurit is a great agilist. He's one of he's one of the better known SPCs out there. He teaches a great Safe class. He teaches a great PSM course. He co-created the professional Scrum with Kanban course with Daniel Vacanti. You know, and when people like that are taking a serious look at Safe, there's some my brother from the Netherlands, Will Seeley, he'll know what I'm talking about. He's another one of those SPC or used to teach Safe, but believes in professional Scrum. Like I just look at that and I'm like, there's some stuff out there that there's good stuff to learn from each and every one of these implementations. And yep. I don't want to do that stuff. And I don't want to do the fighting anymore. It's just, does Safe have some weird things on that big picture map? Absolutely. But when you talk to like Eric Willeke, who says, who came on the Agile for Humans show, he's like, Ryan, if you just look at the map and try to do everything at once, of course it's a disaster. The same can be said of Scrum. The same can be said of Scrum at Scale. But if you take a chopped down version of it, implement slowly, do what makes sense, adapt over time, it can be very powerful. I agree with that. And so, to each their own. But I'm happy to help. If you're in a Safe practice right now and you really want to learn, if you want to deep dive in, like big room planning might be awesome for your PMO, but if you want to figure out at a team level what professional Scrum looks like, I'll always work with you.
Well, and what I will say as we close, to not only support you, Ryan, but also the amazing work that you and Todd did, I think that at its heart, as someone who's been practicing, say, for the last 3 years with clients, it regardless, like you said, regardless of how you plan and how the number of teams that you have on a solution, the number of products that you're trying to support, no matter how big your backlog is, at its core, doing any scaling framework well, I think if you look at every single one of them, I know Safe better than the others, but if you look at most of them at their core, the core of doing good work at scale is about one team working together to get a good thing out. And that's what fixing your Scrum does, is it goes back to the very basic essence of how can we hopefully at a right-sized 5 to 9 people, right? How do we get our work done in a better way, right? And I think that that's what you're trying to do. I think you accomplish it. And if you are, regardless of whether you're using Scrum or not, there's concepts there that you need. And that's probably the biggest endorsement I can give for your book.
And I truly appreciate that. And I'm thinking through what you just said. And when I think about the safe implementations I've seen, the disciplined agile implementations that I've seen, the less implementations that I've seen, the theory of flex that's getting thrown around right now, Scrum at scale, Nexus, like whatever it is that whatever scheme you're using to scale things out, at the core is Scrum. Scrum is at the center. And so you need to fix that, whether you're on a safe team, a dad team, whatever it is. I mean, we need to fix our Scrum, make sure that is solid, because if that doesn't work, the fanciest scaling schemes and planning patterns and all those things, like you mentioned, they fall apart as soon as we can't deliver. And so I appreciate that. I hope we hit that goal. I hope that we've helped teams kind of get their practices back and get on a good footing with Scrum. And if that happens, and so far we've seen some feedback where that could be true, then Todd and I are ecstatic, and we couldn't get higher praise than that. So thank you, Chris.
Absolutely. And again, if for some reason you passed out during the other times we've said it, the title is Fixing Your Scrum: Practical Solutions to Common Scrum Problems. There's a lot of good information in there for you. So, throw Ryan a bone and make his book. Nobody's reading it, and it's got an awful reception. Everybody hates it. Do him a favor and say Merman told me to get this book, and it's pretty good.
Buy 50 copies for your company. I think that would really help.
Yeah. Do that. And again, tell them Chris Merman sent him, and because every referral that you give me, that's an extra drink he has to buy me next time I see him at a conference. So
happy to
and his wife won't be able to argue with it this time.
Well, as long as we're not buying lobster, we'll
stay at that's fair. I think anytime lobster is involved, bad things will happen. So, Ryan, I'm really proud to call you friend, and I'm really proud of the success the book's had and that you've had, and I'm really glad that the book's going well. So proud of you, buddy.
Yeah, I think just thank you, man. That's great, and congratulations again. I'm glad that I'm just happy for you, brother.
Thank you. And thank you again for listening to Agile Uprising. You know where to find us, coalition.agileuprising.com. You can also find us on Patreon, as everybody knows. We got stickers. We're getting more and more stickers out. If you want some fresh stickers for your laptop, so give us a $5 a month contribution. We'll send you some stickers. And he is Ryan Ripley. I am Chris Merman. Thanks, everybody, for listening. See ya.